nights are never nice. The best laid plans of mice and men are never right. I'm just a vagabond with flowers for Algernon, an average Joe who knows what the fuck is going on. It's the hope of my thoughts that I travel upon, fly like an arrow of God until I'm gone. So drifting away like a feather in air, letting my words take me away from the hurt and despair. So I'm keeping it vertical, forever elevator, riding the escalator to the something that is greater. So I'm drifting away like a feather in air, letting my soul take
propaganda, 6 o'clock news and insane cultures clash, all black folk and white trash. They revel in the cyberspace and might crash. Dash to millennium, a million miles are running at the speed of now, bow, no return gunning. Rambo style gun hold child gunning, airbow plow two times loud, stunning.
Stunning when it hits you, lift you off the earth like, hey yo, take you right back to earth. And niggas wonder why, they might wonder why this shit might happen, but it does. They go
drifting away like a feather in air, letting my words take me away from the hurt and despair. So I'm keeping it vertical, forever elevator, riding the escalator to the something that is greater. So I'm drifting away like a feather in air, letting my soul take me away from the hurt and despair. So I'm keeping it vertical, forever elevator, riding the escalator to the something that is greater.
Treat you better than me, cause that's the heavenly key to unlock the inner strength for my essence will be. It's the knowledge of self, understanding of the things around me that
Listen Local. My name is Julian Mark. I'm a reporter with Mission Local, and I'm here with our editor, Lydia Chavez.
Good morning.
We're also here with Joe Eskenazi. Joe, can you hear us?
I can hear you just fine.
Joe, Joe is our columnist and arguably just really the voice of our city, I think. I don't know. That's always the way I thought of you. And you wrote a very good piece about, well, Joe, what was it about?
Well, thank you, Julian. That's very, very kind. Well, essentially, it's about how Chief Bill Scott bucked the San Francisco Police Officers Association on their taser measure. In doing so, setting up an interesting ballot situation and salvaging any reputation he had to be a reformer.
Well, let's just back up. I mean, what is this? What is this ballot measure?
Well, the ballot measure would expedite the timeline of putting tasers in officers' hands, which is something that polls extraordinarily well. What people are less knowledgeable about is what the ballot measure would also do, which is create a framework for using tasers and for disciplining officers who use them badly that's separate and apart from the use of force procedures that we're putting into place.
So
would divorce the police commission and the chief himself from the process of altering it quickly.
So why is this ballot measure so bad now? I mean, why does it make no sense now?
If you're asking why it was introduced now and not 10 years ago, what longtime police associate DOA boss Gary Delanis told me is that his organization was dumb enough to think the city would handle this at some point over the last 10 years. What the real reason is, I don't know. The San Francisco Police Commission greenlit tasers in November and has been working out a policy since then, And according to POA, they're not doing it fast enough, and certainly whatever they do will be less permissive than what the POA is asking voters to approve.
So, okay, I mean, we have all sort of suspected this, and I think it's definitely, but, you know, what does this mean for the chief taking such a, this is probably the biggest stand he's taken against the very powerful police union in, I don't know, his tenure, and we, you know, have all sort of suspected that there has been kind of a tension between the two. He took his command staff off the union. He has, you know, publicly said, you know, the POA is a force to be reckoned with, and so now what is him taking the stand, what does this mean for him moving forward as a reformer?
I think lines have been drawn. I think that a Rubicon has been crossed, and I think that it's a breaking point. The POA was never happy he was here. They wanted one of their own. They weren't happy that Greg Sir was gotten rid of in the first place, and they always want an inside chief who will keep things as they are, more or less. They didn't get that, and in fact, they got the antithesis of that. They got a LAPD officer, which is the last thing they wanted after George Gascon. So they always disliked him, but this is a breaking point. When the figurative head of the police union comes out and calls the chief an idiot, when moments ago the union put out its statement and said that he was, quote, played like a cheap fiddle by members of the police commission, they're painting him as a subhuman, as someone who's not his own man, as someone who is a feather being blown about by other forces. Now, between us, I think it's kind of a stretch to say that the police commission controls the police chief. That strikes me as extremely unlikely. But that is the line that is being pushed.
Do you think this is the POA talking? This is the police union talking. To what extent do you think that represents rank and file? Do you think rank and file is up for a fight?
That's the million-dollar question, Lydia. Maybe even a billion-dollar question, considering that they have union negotiations coming up. I think that police enjoy being paid well. I think police enjoy the spirited defense that this union provides for its workforce, which every union does and should do. To go a little bit astray from your question here, Mayor Mark Farrell put out a defense of his own, saying that he supports the taser policy and he supports the taser measure. And he is the one who's negotiating that new memorandum of understanding for 10 years with the police department. So that'll be an interesting thing to follow as well.
So we have a mayor that really is going against the kind of the structure that has been set up to manage the police. I mean, he's just the mayor also is going around the mayor
is saying he disagrees with the police chief. If Mark Farrell was the full-time mayor, the police chief would probably have to worry about his job security, but he's not.
But he's also saying that he disagrees with the police commission. He disagrees with the city apparatus.
Yes, he does. How you feel depends upon whether you buy the POA's argument that they, police commission and all the powers that be, have been sitting on the ball when it comes to formulating taser use policy. Frankly, that's a very hard policy one to believe for me. They only approved tasers in November, and it's just March 1st today. I think that, you know, having a reasonable policy in place when you start giving officers tasers and allowing them to put hundreds and thousands of volts through people is probably a good idea. I am told that that policy could be introduced as soon as this month.
Now, another question is, I mean, it will, now that the chief has kind of come out against this, does that necessarily, you know, give any sort of, compromise the measure's chances of passing? I mean, it polled at 76%. Does this change anything?
Yes, but I don't know if it's enough, and it depends what he does now. If he writes the ballot measure against it, that would be interesting. I don't see any reason why he shouldn't do that, being as he's already, you know, I mean, it's not like the POA is going to be less pissed. He might as well take it to its logical conclusion and write the ballot argument and do all those sorts of things. The POA told me they're going to put $500,000, maybe more, into this fight. There's no way anybody's putting a comparable amount of money into fighting against it, fighting against the ballot measure that's already polling well. Perhaps the ACLU will put some money in, perhaps they won't. So I think it's going to pass, but I think that any chance it had of not passing has just been rekindled a little bit with Bill Scott saying he doesn't support it.
So just to maybe wrap up, what is going on here? Because you did have the police commission agree to tasers. You did have that policy going forward. They have 2019 as the date when, you know, tasers are supposed to be in the hands of police. That was in motion. Police chief Scott and many other police officers went to all of these hearing meetings, talked to the public, endured this, you know, year-long process to get this thing approved, and now you have the police union going against it and really begging for a fight.
And a fight they'll get, because there are actionable measures within their proposed legislation here. As noted in my column, this would allow for the tasing of someone who is quote-unquote assaultive. Use of force experts I talked to said that was so lax that it could invite litigation. Assaultive is a very broad term. You and I, when we hear the word assaultive, we think of people, you know, doing mixed martial arts type things. But if someone taps you on the shoulder, legally, that's an assault.
Right.
If someone says, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to get you, that's an assault. You know, and most of us would probably not think that a tasing would be the next thing to do. What's more, the taser policy as proposed by the POA is separate and apart from the use of force policy that the police had done. The de-escalation procedures are not in there. You don't have to try and talk someone down or give distance and time. You can just tase them.
Right.
And this is problematic.
Wow. Yeah. So and reading between the lines, what do you read? I mean, what is going on here? Are they trying to force a fight and push him out? Or are they...
I think they've already forced that fight, Lydia.
Yep.
I think that we're in the midst of that fight, and this was the counterpunch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to use the analogy that I used in the column because it involves profanity, but they took a big dump on the chief, and they took a big dump on the collaborative process. And there was no way he couldn't respond, otherwise he'd be perceived as emasculated and weak.
Yep.
And there's no way that he could be seen as a reformer when he allows people to do this, which is a double punch. It's an attack on the collaborative process. It's an attack on his authority, and it's an attack on civilian oversight of the police.
Now, if this passes, does the police commission or any sort of legal body within the city have any recourse to kind of push their their policies?
Well, as noted before, there is possibility for litigation, and within the language of the taser measure, which is short, it's only about 2 pages of actionable text. They're allowed to make policy changes, but only those that that don't supersede the measure.
Hmm.
So they can't contravene anything that's in the measure. So the measure kind of saddles them.
Wow.
And certainly if, maybe tasers are handed out and everything is peachy, but maybe not. You know, maybe there's a rash of officers using them improperly, tasing people improperly. They will be powerless to do anything about that. They certainly can't rescind them.
Hmm.
In an extreme case that Commissioner Bob Hirsch brought up, what if there's a technical glitch and the tasers keep exploding? They will not have any recourse to take them out of the hands of officers.
Mm-hmm.
So those are extreme cases, but that would be allowed. And you do take things to the extreme case when you look at what's permissible under the law or not permissible.
Well, Joe, we really appreciate you taking the time, and we don't want to keep you. but thanks for coming on, and looking forward to hearing from you next time.
I'll be around.
Okay.
Thank you kindly,
right.
And apologies to my fellow bus travelers here.
Oh, no, no problem. Take it easy.
Thank you.
God.
I love that guy.
Yeah, really. I mean, amazing column, really. If you guys aren't already reading Joe Eskenazi's work in the Mission Local, you should be. It's just really terrific, and we're really, really happy to have him writing for us. It's this whole thing with Scott and the police union is just... it's really coming to a head, and you sort of wonder, Scott has been sort of quietly been pushing reform, quietly been trying to sort of open up to the community a bit, but maybe too quietly.
Well, but I just think it's very reassuring, if he just kind of sat quiet through this whole thing and didn't come out against the measure or,
yes.
didn't say anything, I would have been even more worried that he was a little bit more passive. And here, I think it's very symbolic that he's
mm-hmm.
taking a stand, and he's taking a stand for the reforms and for the correct process of
mm-hmm.
the way police are, are regulated here in San Francisco.
Yes.
So I was quite happy with that.
Yep. No, the police department has had this other issue. We had this case come up this week. The whole issue of reform began with the police shootings and the texting scandal and accountability and the idea of holding police officers accountable. And in a sense, none of the cases of police shootings and none of the cases of the texting have police officers been held accountable. And you went and covered a press conference yesterday or the day before on Luis Gongora, another homeless man who was shot by police, and the case is still under investigation, and no charges have been filed. And what happened at the press conference?
I was just waiting outside with sort of everybody, other reporters, activists, for the advocate for the family of Luis Gongora, Adriana Camarena. They were in a 50-minute meeting with George Gascon, the San Francisco district attorney, and she basically told us that he gave her and the family of Luis Gongora a lecture on the law and why these cases are so difficult to try, essentially, to bring charges against.
And the argument being?
Well, the argument was actually just what I expected. It's that these cases are extremely subjective, and they rely on essentially the officer's word. If there is any question that the officer may have perceived a threat, in air quotes there, perceived a threat, then the officers technically acted within the law. It doesn't matter what other people saw. It doesn't matter what a body camera saw. It matters what the officer felt at the time, and that leaves him on pretty solid ground legally.
Mm-hmm. No, it's tough, but it does also leave this perception from the public's point of view that no one is being held accountable. So it makes, in a way, everything that Chief Scott does in terms of pushing reform and pushing sort of the way in which things should happen very important.
So. And especially now, I mean, Adriana kind of brought this point up. Gascon set up this $1.5 million or $1.8 million, you know, a very large sum of money unit to take a closer look at all of these sort of backlogged police shooting cases. And she says, you know, or, you know, at least to the public's point of view, he set this whole thing up. And, you know, will a closer examination of these cases actually do anything? I mean, what is all this money going into if legally, you know, the standard is so high to say a cop acted outside of the law,
mm-hmm,
and unlawfully during a shooting?
Okay, well, moving away from police and police reform, which we could go on forever on, there's been a lot of development issues.
Yeah, don't
tell us about some of them. We've got that laundromat.
I think we both kind of we're kind of on different sides of on the line here. I mean, so Bob Tillman, or let's say, you know, there's a developer. Quite controversial, wants to set up a 75-unit apartment building on Mission between, I think, 24th and 25th. And it's at the site of this laundromat, and it's seen some reviews. It's been in the pipeline since 2014. And just a couple weeks ago, the Board of Supervisors voted to allow it to be reviewed historically as a historical resource, and that may take that delayed the project 5 more months. Now, it was bedlam for especially the YIMBY movement. They are the political movement that wants to just build housing, which makes sense. And but the other side says, you know, maybe we should just take a look at this. Maybe we should take a look at you know, whether or not history happened here.
And what did you discover when you went over there?
Well, quite a bit of history happened there, actually. And it was, you know, there are people that this was essentially the hub of, you know, Mission activism and in the 1970s. And they and the Mission model neighborhoods, and basically they were connected to the Mission coalition organization, which was a political body that essentially was, you know, that pretty much was reacting to the redevelopment going on throughout the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot that happened there, and a lot of you know, established organizations like the Mission Housing Development Corporation had their beginnings there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, what do you do about that? I mean, I know in the case of, and it kind of made me angry, in the case of the Mexican Museum, which started on a building on Folsom, and is definitely part of Mission history and is important because now they're going to have a huge big museum downtown. And when I went to try and find any sort of remnant or evidence of the Mexican Museum, of course it's gone, and UCSF, I think, has a building there now. And there's not even a plaque, which I think a plaque would have been nice to have, just sort of a history plaque. But can you see preserving this because of the organizations that met there?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, you go to the laundromat, it just looks like a laundromat. In fact, it's just like, you know, you kind of do, you know, look, do these geological surveys and just the strata, you know, of history. It really is a few layers down here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go inside and you see all of these ancient things that came even after this, you know, all of this history. You see the old arcade games, a picture of blimps that looks, you know, faded, right, since the 90s. I mean, it really is. I mean, really, the history is the laundromat, and that's not something that we need to necessarily preserve.
Right.
It's the history is just not apparent. And in fact, you know, while doing the story, one of the guys who just has written extensively on this, and in fact, you know, was a founding member of the MCO, basically said, hey, you know, a lot of stuff happened here, but it's not about the building.
Yeah, no, it's I think all of those organizations also met in places like La Boheme and had, you know, meetings in La Boheme, and yet you wouldn't preserve that. But it would be kind of nice to have a plaque there, although I'm sure Tillman would do that easily if people talked to him.
Or maybe not. I mean, he really just is not interested in... he is... I mean, this the reason why, you know, I kind of wanted to, you know, shed light on this is that, you know, Tillman has been very... he's been very stubborn in his, in including more than, you know, I don't know, 11% affordable housing. And it's, you know, the question is it the responsibility of a developer who owns the land to give the community more affordability in the area? I don't know.
Wow, Julian, you're starting to sound like a socialist. I mean, why would it be his responsibility? We're in a capitalist society.
We are in a capitalist
society. I mean, he's doing what the state and the city require of him, which is giving 11% housing.
That's true, but I think that maybe, given the situation in the city, you could if you... At least for your own interests, at least for the sake of expediting a project or making it less hard, not having to go through all of these environmental reviews, these historical reviews, maybe give the community what they want and you can get your project done faster. I think the guy's, you know, he's losing money no matter what. And, you know, the question is how much money is he losing either way? Affordable housing bites into your profit margin, but so does time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he doesn't seem to be buying that argument.
No, not at all.
I don't think he's going to go for it. And it's interesting. I mean, in your story and in the comments to the story, it does seem like they had done some historical review already, and they had decided that it's in the comments section.
Oh, perhaps. Yeah, perhaps they, you know.
No, it was not a serious dig into the history.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. Well, I guess time will tell. The planning department will make their determination about whether or not this is a historic resource. This project will probably go forward.
And usually it's like in a case of Superior Auto on 16th Street, which there was just a meeting that we were both at. I was there as a neighbor. You were there as a reporter. It was a little awkward. And that building has already been, they've established that it is historically important because of the facade, because of the architecture. And that is here to stay. So,
and it kind of sadly, it's here to stay because
sadly.
well, here you are. I mean, at least it should go through this process. At least it should be recognized. You know that the developer at least expressed bought the place with the intention of building housing there. And I, you know, of course, you know, I want more housing. Mm-hmm. I want, you would have to build it with this, you know, the 16-20% affordable housing, you know, as it is, if he's to develop it now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem is he now because he has to keep the building, he finds the building housing on top of it too expensive. I'm really unclear as to why they're not going forward with some sort of housing, because the elbow room, which is also historical, they went ahead with housing and just set it the housing back a little bit from the facade. So I'm unclear as to why he can't do that.
Well, I cannot spell out his exact reasons, but on the phone the other day, he definitely told me that when he presented those plans to the city told him that was not viable. Now we can, of course, press him more to take a, you know, sort of a deeper look at this, but at least the feeling that I got when talking to him on the phone, and I did speak on the phone with him for a better part of an hour, he wanted to build housing there. You know, he wants to build housing. He still wants to build housing there. And if he can, he will. and that's where the moneymaker is. As it is, he wants to put an events space/bar/restaurant into this very large building that may or may not, you know, that may or may not support, you know, a big operator like that. And, you know, I don't know, you said that you've seen operators go through building, you know, larger buildings like this.
I mean, I think the only really successful large kind of event space restaurant, well, the Public Works is a successful, it seems to me, event space. It's sort of off away from residential neighborhoods, as far as I know. And the other one is Foreign Cinema, which opened in the early 1990s, and that's been very successful. I think it was the first 10,000 square foot restaurant in the Mission. But the other places that are large, there's a place at 280 Valencia Street that has just had one, you know, operator after another. It's just too large a space. I think when people come to the Mission, they want a more intimate dining experience. And somehow, even restaurants that have done really well in Silicon Valley or really well elsewhere that try and move in there don't make it. It's just, I don't know, it's not in a, it's too big. So I think he's going to have problem finding a successful operator there. I hope he does reconsider housing. As a neighbor, I'm not that thrilled about having, you know, another bar in the area that there are already plenty of bars. But I think the neighbors that are going to be most affected are probably my block, and then, of course, the block that actually the building is in. I'm across the street from it.
Yeah, so I think he gets the sense that he's sort of inherited a bit of a mess, and, you know, that he's kind of inherited just kind of a big pain in the behind, mm-hmm. you know, moving forward, having to find an operator, having to keep that operator in, and not being able to just kind of sell the thing off. It's going to be hard to sell it off, you know, if you, with this kind of business and with this, you know, I don't know, this historical status here.
He does seem, though, I mean, at the meeting, it almost seemed odd to me that he had paid too much. And now, you know, he was stuck trying to put something in that was going to make money because he paid too much for a place, thinking that it could be housing. But after your conversation with him, it does seem like he's a very experienced developer, and somehow...
Well, he's experienced enough, and how he sort of said it to me is that we bought it with no thinking that we could knock it down, and because of the climate at the time, this is when the Mission, you know, housing moratorium was going on the ballot. For those of you who don't know, that would have halted all development in the Mission for a certain period of time. And... basically, the city told them that the climate in the neighborhood is just not going to take your housing right now, so you have to sort of go fish.
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be any neighborhood reaction to Mercedes-Benz moving into the block on 14th Street, the warehouse?
Well, you know, I'm not really sure, because I don't know if there are too many houses around there, and I'm not sure where it would sort of.
Yeah, it's more warehousey. I actually walked back from a art opening the other night and walked down 14th Street, and there are many other, you know, car. It's sort of the place where the car dealerships are on 14th Street, and heading towards South Venice.
Well, I'm unclear. Is it a dealership, or is it a service shop?
It seems like it's going to be a service shop. Maybe a dealership. It was kind of unclear from the documents.
Now, yeah, it is a bit unclear. It said that it had, oh, I don't know, over 500, you know, storage spaces for cars. So perhaps it's, you know, it is going to be a dealer, or maybe sort of a storage house. But if anything, you know, even though it's Mercedes-Benz, this is something that I think neighborhood activists want. They want this production, distribution, and repair space, and they want these blue-collar jobs that are, you know, going to be, right, you know, servicing these cars. I mean, if anything, yes, of course, you know, the optics of it being Mercedes-Benz is, you know, it may be tough to swallow, but...
And it fits with a whole neighborhood down there. Another thing I thought for that Superior Auto space, although I don't think that... it was pretty clear from the meeting that the Calle 24 people would not be for this, is workspace, you know, some sort of workspace, because it's, I mean, they say, all the studies show that near transit corridors, you should either have housing or office space. And that would seem to me a very good place for office space, open workspace. But of course, that means tech to some, and that's...
Be careful.
I know, but you know, who's working here, and they need a place to work. I mean, it just, you know... I mean, it could also have community groups as well. It might be just a mixed-use workspace.
Yeah, but that, you know, that to me, community groups, nonprofits, well, I mean, is that really that good for business?
Yeah, no, that's true. Okay, well...
Well, we can go on this for... we can go on and on for hours, but that's why you should tune in next week. I'm Julian Mark.
Lydia Chavez.
Thanks for listening to Listen Local.